And so I believe that over the course of, I don't know if it's 5 years, 10 years, the most affordable way for consumers to shop and a brand to still profit from a sale of a good will be in a physical store.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Chris Ressa joined DLC Management Corp in 2007. During this tenure, his relationships, real estate expertise, and leadership have led to numerous successful repositioning of assets. With a track record of consistently beating budgets and increasing NOI, Chris has played a significant role in the overall growth of the organization. Now, as the Chief Operating Officer, Chris oversees DLC's $2.5 billion asset portfolio and is responsible for all property-level operations, including leasing, property management, construction, and marketing on all owned assets. Despite a hectic work schedule, Chris invests a significant amount of his personal time creating thought-provoking content, sparking great engagement on social media, and his presence on LinkedIn is no less impressive, as you have, 28,900 followers? Chris, that's crazy. And your retail and real estate posts are often the top of the trending board. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Hey, man, that's a lot of work, I think, that goes into building a brand and building a following on LinkedIn like that. No?
Yeah. Doesn't happen in a couple minutes unless you're a celebrity or have something crazy to say, but it's taken a long time. Yeah, I think it's been a lot of work, but I think hopefully over time it'll be fruitful.
Man, that's fantastic. I'm looking forward to jumping in more, on that topic. The same questions I ask everybody who comes on the show is, where did you start? Where are you now? And briefly, just how did you get there?
Professionally?
You can answer that question any way you like.
All right. So professionally, my first job out of college, I worked for the Sherwin-Williams company, the paint stores company, and I was in their corporate real estate department. So we were out trying to find new locations to open stores. We were out trying to find new offices to lease. We were looking at new industrial stuff. So my first job out of college was on the commercial real estate side, just from a tenant perspective. Mm-hmm. I realized I really enjoyed commercial real estate and wanted to get on the landlord developer side. And I did that. I made the move from the corporate real estate and the tenant side to the developer landlord side in 06. And I've been there ever since. And that's the story.
Wow. So can you break down the pieces of that? You know, what do those two things mean, and how did that position change one to the next?
So at Sherwin-Williams and the tenant, right? If you go and you drive down the road today and you see a Sherwin-Williams, they're leasing space in shopping centers or leasing freestanding buildings. And if you go to some office buildings or industrial complexes, they're a tenant of, you know, investment groups like yours or major landlords or REITs or private owners across the country. And so I was on that side of it, and I decided that I really liked the more of the real estate and wasn't sure that my career was going to be in the paint business, which is that business that they are in. Right. And so I started looking for opportunities on the real estate side, thinking I could bring a little bit of insights being on the inside of how a tenant in a major enterprise looks at their real estate portfolio, even though it's a lease portfolio. Now, I was only there a short time. I was a year and a half at Sherwin-Williams, but I definitely learned a lot at that time about how major corporations think about their real estate portfolio and how they think about growing their real estate portfolio. So that helped me when I got to the landlord developer side. And when I say landlord developer, I just mean someone or company that owns real estate or builds real estate, and they lease it out to commercial tenants. And I stayed in the retail realm. Most of what I did with it, Sherwin-Williams, was in the retail realm, their stores. And yeah, that's what I meant by that.
Right. And so now you're in 2007, you joined DLC. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, awesome. So you joined DLC and you guys are doing landlording, you're doing developer, you're on the side. That's where you've been, since 2007.
Yep.
And since you're in retail, I mean, retail, of course, it means a lot of things to a lot of different people.
Sure.
What does retail mean to you guys, and where do you find your what do you see as opportunity in retail right now?
The retail as an asset class to me is the most fun because it's the most complex by far. It's clearly the most product types, right? You have enclosed malls, you have grocery anchored centers, you have freestanding buildings, whether it's McDonald's or what have you, you have outlet centers, you have what people call power centers. Those are the large open air centers that are, call it Target, Dick's Sporting Goods, Best Buy. You have lifestyle centers, you have mixed use projects. And a lot of companies specialize in one of those areas because they're different businesses. And so the retail landscape is complex, so I find that exciting. And I think that today the opportunity is for us, we believe there's a strong opportunity in the open air shopping center format. That's what we own, which is grocery anchored centers, power centers. And we are a value add player. So we're buying things that are have upside and using our platform to generate value out of that, which typically means it's either broken or under leased, under managed. And we have the platform to go in and, add value to it. We are a fully integrated vertical platform. So we buy it, we lease it, we own it, we manage it, we build it, we do everything inside. So we're not third partying everything. Our value proposition is the people inside, and that we can add value with our platform and our relationships and our expertise. And that's what we do.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, what when you say value add, I know you mentioned, maybe lease renegotiations or re-tenanting or things like that, but can you give a little more color to what value add maybe?
Yeah, I mean, you're talking typically probably upper teens, low 20s IRRs, something like that, right? And if you think of a multi deal, that's a 4 cap. No matter the asset class, we're probably not the buyer for that.
Right. Yeah. You guys aren't buying on a 4 cap.
It's just
a,
right.
And do you think, one of the things I think retail's gotten a bad name, right?
Like, sure.
You've heard a lot of people saying, well, retail's dead, which is, I think obviously you're here to disprove that theory or are disproving that theory entirely, by telling us what you guys can do in this space. But why are people saying that?
I think there's a lot of things that people are saying. One, clearly the e-commerce push. And we believe that clearly e-commerce is going to grow. But if you look at retail sales in America today, I would ask you, Sam, what percentage of total retail sales in America today are done in a store?
I have no idea. I mean, I would only be able to say anecdotally from my own experience, which is, grocery stores. But I mean, I don't know. No idea. What's the answer?
It's about 80%. So only 20% of retail sales are done online. And a significant amount of those retail sales are done by brands that have a large brick and mortar presence. Walmart, Target, these brands. Obviously, Amazon has a huge presence, but they're also building physical stores. They've been, rolling out their grocery stores across the country and whatnot. And so what I think the punchline is you have some retailers that didn't evolve. And so maybe they don't belong anymore, but that doesn't mean that retail's dead. That just means that retailer, that business might not be working anymore. This year, we're set in America to probably have more stores open than close, which coming out of the pandemic is pretty extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's pretty extraordinary when you think about last year and the total retail sales in America. People were stuck at home through a pandemic that we're still going through, and majority of the sales were still done online, are still done in a store.
Right.
That's fascinating, right? Even though they're stuck at home. And I think when you think about the other side and you think about the online only brands that are profitable is very, very small brand is potentially cheaper than a brick and mortar store. You don't have to build it. There's no rent. But the minute you want to scale the infrastructure and the ability to grow revenue by acquiring other customers starts to get really costly. We've done a lot of homework, and the customer acquisition cost, which is essentially marketing by many online only brands, is more than the marketing and real estate cost of some traditional retailers combined. And so I believe that over the course of, I don't know if it's 5 years, 10 years, the most affordable way for consumers to shop and a brand to still profit from a sale of a good will be in a physical store. You know, she can't order 4 shirts, return 3, and the retailer still make money and pay no shipping and still make money.
Right.
So it's just not sustainable. And so these are the things, though, when you're seeing the growth of e-commerce, when you look at the headline news and you see, you know, e-commerce grew by 20% or 15%, that's its own, but that's not as a percentage of total retail sales. That's just as, you know, it's on its own growth. And so it looks like, wow, this is really challenging. And then you look at the department stores, which have been the bellwether of retail for a long time, going through a massive change and a shift, people start to question retail. I have an opinion, and I don't know what the stat was, but it was like 1.8 million online stores in America pre-pandemic. I don't know what it is today. And there was many less physical stores. You know, people say we're overstored in America. I think we have too many digital stores in America, way more than we do physical stores.
Interesting.
Now, that's a Chris Ressa opinion that you're not going to find a lot of, but I go on a limb and I say, we don't have too many physical stores. We have too many digital stores.
Right. Right. Just because what you're saying, and when you say that, are you thinking that we have too many in the sense that, you know, like you just mentioned, their customer acquisition cost is too high?
Yeah, I meant from the business side profitability. It's for the end consumer, the amount of digital and physical stores should be a good thing from a price perspective, from a differentiated product perspective. But for American business to deliver that and be profitable is not easy.
Right. Right. Yeah. And that's a fantastic point. What would you say when you buy 4 shirts, ship back 3
and pay no shipping? How can the business make any money?
Right. Right. Unless they're charging $200 a shirt, and then
exactly. Then you should go buy it in the store because it's way cheaper.
Right. Right. Yeah. That's a very valid point. That's really fascinating. You know, what are department stores? Since you mentioned it, what are department stores doing? I mean,
there's a bunch of things that they're doing. I think, you know, I do think how consumers shop even in a physical world is changing. And so, you know, we've been very bullish on the open air shopping center format and less on the enclosed mall format. But, you know, I do think we're over malled in America. We have too many enclosed malls. They were too big, and how consumer shop has changed, both from a convenience and a type of product. And so department stores in the top tier malls are still doing really well. It's what the world might call B and C malls, where they've been challenged and they're thinking about what to do. You know, I think Macy's is a good example. We actually signed a deal with Macy's to open their Backstage concept, which is an off-price concept similar to TJ Maxx or Ross or Burlington, which is that treasure hunt off-price discounted good, which is different than a full price traditional behemoth department store. We signed one of the first ones in their new rollout of this concept in the country and in our center in Allen, Texas. And it looks great. It's doing well and traffic's pretty high. And so they're doing things and they're being innovative. They're obviously all, you know, focused on the omni channel. And so there's that. The other thing with, you know, retail real estate, getting away from the retailer perspective, if you think about the shipping in this last mile and this challenge, whether it's industrial, whether it's retail or whatever it is, the reality is the goal is to get products as close to the consumer as possible so you can get faster delivery time. Well, in America, the closest real estate to the end consumer is retail real estate. We had this over the last decade. And so from an investment class, I like that. What does that mean from a redevelopment and a CapEx perspective? Could be challenging. But one of the things that I point to is in about 2008, 2009, in general, the healthcare industry wanted to get closer to the consumer. And what did they say? They basically said, and I'm paraphrasing, I don't know when I say they, I don't know who is, I'm talking about the industry, that anything that doesn't require an overnight stay, they're trying to get out of the hospital. Running out of space in hospital, hospital real estate's very inefficient, hard to run from a real estate cost perspective. And so what did they do? They wanted to get closer to the consumer, so you had options very close to you. They ended up in retail real estate. If you think about shopping centers across America, you have urgent cares everywhere. You have across America, you have all these different medical uses in shopping centers, because that real estate is the closest real estate to the end consumer. And so I think the medical one's a good example that, you know, if you want to get close to the consumer, the retail real estate's where it is.
Yeah.
And one of the things I think, one of the challenges to the regional mall, which is obviously retail real estate, is that it's regional, large trade areas, but not necessarily as close to the consumer, right? You drive to the regional mall. So some of those uses who are like, their goal is just to get as close as you can to the end consumer. The other products of retail real estate might make it more conducive. That's not saying there's not a, there's not, you know, significantly strong retail purposes for strong regional malls. It's to say that, you know, there's a lot of other type of retail real estate that's close to the end consumer.
Mm-hmm. That's really fascinating. You know, so what is it then that you guys are finding is your sweet spot?
So we buy grocery anchored and power center. So think about the Walmart, TJ Maxx, Dick's Sporting Goods Center with a Starbucks and Chipotle out on the front. Or where are you from?
Memphis.
Memphis. So if you think about like a Kroger anchored shopping center with a, you know, the nail salon, the pizza shop, and a PetSmart, right? That's the shopping center that we're owning across the country. Now, we're buying it less occupied and maybe in need of a little TLC. And that's where we're adding our, you know, so hopefully we're buying it at a, because it's in that condition, we're buying it at a higher cap rate, and we're able to create some yield based, you know, using our platform to reinvigorate it.
Right, right. Man, that's fantastic. Like that's the, and that's, you know, it's a lot of what I've heard is the, you know, the grocery store anchored spaces, things like that. How are even the larger retailers, you know, some of the things that in this, again, this is just me from the outside perspective looking in, I would think that even larger stores like Dick's Sporting Goods and places like that would be struggling right now. But it sounds like that's not the case.
I think that, yeah, I think, the retail's on fire. The end consumer is as strong as it's ever been. We gave them money, and right. And so they saved more than they ever did. They had, they had stimulus from the government, and, you know, now they're employed and they've got pent up demand because they've been sitting at home. And I don't think people want to work at home, sleep at home, eat at home, shop at home, work out at home, and do everything at home.
Right. They want to get out and experience life a little bit. Imagine that.
Yeah. So I think that's all led to significant sales. There are many retailers. I think it's pretty easy for retailers to comp up to 20, you know, for the non-essential retailers, the essential retailers that were dubbed that, like the grocery stores and wholesale clubs that you were allowed to go to in the pandemic, they obviously had record sales, and it's hard this year to comp up over that. But the non-essential retailers, they were closed for a while last year, so it's an easier comp to Wall Street, right? They're comping up, but they're also comping up ahead of 19, many of these retailers. So that speaks to the pent-up demand, that speaks to the robust wallet of the end consumer and the desire to get out of the house.
Right, right. Man, that's a great point. Are there, we've talked a little bit, you know, about the opportunities. We've talked some about the, some of the headwinds that are maybe facing retail. you know, and it sounds like there's opportunity. You guys are finding, like you said, you're buying on somewhere between 15 and 20.
Well, what I would tell you, so we bought, you know, buying's not easy, right? It's competitive. We're not the only ones with this view. And there's, you know, people in your space who are looking for yield going to retail because you don't have to pay a 3 cap for what's probably a much better credit profile rent roll.
Right.
I don't know what type of, are you class A or class B? What type of apartments do you have?
You know, we're B and C, you know, prefer.
So when you think about the credit of your tenant versus my tenant,
right.
And the stability, right. I get I sign a 10-year lease with Walmart, which is number one on Fortune 500. And I can get a better yield than you can get on all your tenants and the credit profile.
Right.
It's an interesting opportunity.
Oh gosh. Yeah. Gosh. Yeah. No, there's huge merit to it. And I love talking retail people like yourself because you bring a perspective that, you know, a lot of people don't have because they're not in it. You know, it's usually guys on the sidelines going, man, that's a bad asset class to be in. Well, you're not involved in it. So you don't.
Listen, it's not all lollipops and rainbows. I will tell you that. Sure. It's not lollipops and rainbows all the time, but there's opportunity.
Right. And that's it. And having the skill set, you know, to see and seize upon that opportunity, I think is really, really where it is. And you guys are obviously well positioned for that. What have been some things in your, I guess, going on 14-year tenure with DLC that you would say you guys have done right? And maybe what are some things that you would have done differently?
This is more of a business perspective than an investment perspective. So, you know, we're a 130-person company. And I think one of the shifts that we made coming out of the Great Recession was we're people first, assets second. And the reality is, in my opinion, you know, real estate's, you know, you mentioned myths before. I think in any asset class, location matters, but not as much as people. And it's the people behind the location that makes it work. And so we have taken that to heart and focused on the team more than anything. And if you take care of the team and you focus on the team, and they in turn will hopefully take care of the assets. And so I think, you know, the biggest thing, if I were to pick one change that we really got right, was, you know, focus on culture and people in the organization. I think, you know, the things that, you know, I think we also have been a disciplined acquirer for sure. And then I think we've done a really good job of like repositioning and redeveloping. You know, I think in the pre-Great Recession, we had the approach that like we're not sellers. Mm-hmm. And we had some assets with some high LTVs and, you know, ended up doing a bunch of workouts and, you know, had some, you know, realized, well, maybe there is a time to exit some assets. And obviously, you know that, but we were kind of buying things and thinking, you know, this is really, really long-term hold. And, you know, now we have an exit strategy. We might keep it long-term, but we have an exit strategy on everything. And so I think that was a key investment piece.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's interesting because, you know, you hear two schools of thought on that, which is one, buy and hold forever. You know, there's certain investors, it's like, why sell the milk cow? And then, you know, for you, you're saying, hey, look, there is a time, you know, to incorporate that exit into the.
Yeah, I because you never know what's going to happen to the market and how the market's going to shift in any asset class.
Right.
And if you're not in a position to deal with massive market shifts, which happen unexpectedly, you're going to lose a lot of money.
Right. Man, that's sage advice. That's, yeah, that's awesome. Thank you. You've given some great color, I think, to things you guys have done right and things that you would, you know, do differently. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, growing an online personal brand and, you know, having now 28, almost 29,000 people following what you do. I know you talked at the beginning that you said, hey, this is a long-term strategy, but why have you poured so heavily into that? And what are some things that you put out content-wise that you find that your listeners and followers want to engage with?
I'll start at the end, which is I post a lot about on business leadership, retail, and real estate. I stay in my lane in those three areas. And someone said to me a long time ago that, you know, the new channels are no longer ESPN, ABC, and Fox. They're LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, and so on.
Right.
And it's free to market on there. And I said, you know, that's a pretty interesting concept. And so I decided to take a, you know, a 10, 20 year view and say, I'm going to make a presence here to help the, you know, mine and the DLC brand have better brand awareness, position ourselves as thought leaders in the marketplace, because we are, and, you know, get out to the world what we're doing, what we're accomplishing, what, you know, our failures are and what are our successes. And I started doing that like 2016 or 17. You know, people often ask, has it paid dividends? Hard to quantify like anything else in marketing, but I would tell you that I think over the course of time, if you said, is it better to have done it or better to not, you know, I'm still posting and I'm still going all in and we're enhancing it. One of the big things we did was we created a podcast ourselves called Retail Retold, which is the story of how that store ended up in your neighborhood. I say people will sit around a table and say, they put Starbucks over there. I say the show brings you who they is and how it happened. So I think that when you have, you know, you have this opportunity, right? That, you know, if you want to put an ad out on NBC, it's pretty expensive.
Right.
Well, it's a lot different on social media. And I think that opportunity to me was invaluable. And it's not always who you know, it's who knows you. And so the social media gives you that opportunity.
Right. Man, that's cool. That's very cool. I love that. Before we jump here into the final four, is there anything else that you would like to share with our listeners as it pertains to DLC, as it pertains to, you know, social media or retail or anything on any of those fronts?
I would just say, check out our website, dlcmgmt.com, and check out our podcast, Retail Retold. I think it's be insightful on just business deals in general. And then, you know, how your community got shaped like it did.
And I'm actually going to listen to that because that's an intriguing angle that, you know, a lot of us probably don't. And it's funny, you mentioned Starbucks because I was driving on the road yesterday and I literally, there was an old Starbucks and it disappeared. Now it's some chicken joint. And then like 200 yards down the road on the other side of the street, there's a brand new Starbucks. And I'm like,
we have an episode with Starbucks on there. We're like 150 episodes in. So it was an interesting one that was an engineering angle, less about a business deal, but you could check it out.
Yeah, right. And those are fascinating conversations. Like why did they pick that? How did it wind up across there? And
you got it.
200 yards away, they closed one and opened another one. Like, okay, this is really interesting. So I'll have to dig in on that
episode. Was the first one, did they have a drive-through?
They did.
Oh, huh.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a big one for them, right? If they have a store without a drive-through, moving to a location that has a drive-through, that's something you'll see a lot.
Sure. Yeah. I don't know what the deal is. Of course, you know, that I'll have to listen to your podcast and find out kind of some of the thoughts behind it.
There you go.
That's fascinating, man. Hey, here's the final four questions. The first one's this. If I gave you just $20,000 to invest in real estate with no previous real estate investing experience, what would you do with it and why?
Well, what I would do is I would spend it on networking and learning real estate versus an asset class so that I could learn more. There's two angles that I would do. First, I would spend the money on learning. One. Two, I wanted to go on my own. The next thing I might do is I might do a single family rental to just get my feet wet and learn about some of the process. It's different than apartment complexes or retail centers, but there's some tangible lessons to be learned. Or three, I might be one of the things, and two of my friends recommend this all the time, which is be an LP and see what they're doing, learn what they're doing. And then you could start to get to learn some things and you start to get your feet wet on investing. And then potentially, if you wanted to go on the other side and run a deal, you've had some experience along the way.
Right. Yeah, that's a very valuable way to learn. Absolutely. Question number two is this. If you could help our listeners avoid just one mistake in real estate, what would it be and how would you avoid it?
In most of real estate, there's a lot of things you can do to turn a good deal into a great deal. There's very few things you can do to turn a bad deal into a good deal.
Right. So avoid the bad deals.
So
excellent.
Like when the opportunity zone craze happened, mm-hmm. everyone was like looking at opportunity zones. They're looking at anything. And one of the things was like, opportunity zone might make a good deal better, but it's really going to make a bad deal good.
Right. Right. That's yeah. Well said. Well said. I like that a lot. When it comes to investing in the world, what's one thing you're doing right now to make the world a better place?
Oh man, that's a great question. I probably could do better at this, but I think, you know, at DLC, so I'm going to go on a real estate one here.
Sure.
So we've had a big push and we're almost done. If you think about retail real estate, we own a lot of parking lot. Almost done in all the parking lots to LED conversions.
Hmm. That's got to be a humongous power saving.
We're still going through the numbers. Some of it, sometimes it's big. Sometimes I'm like yelling at people going, how could this be? How could we not have saved more money? But the answer is in general, yes.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah. I mean, those are the small things you do that you go, wait, this, we can cut back on our energy consumption dramatically. So that's fantastic. Last question, Chris, I think you already answered this, but just so we always get them in sequence, if our listeners want to get in touch with you, what is the best way to do that?
Best way would be to reach out to me on LinkedIn. You can follow my hashtag Ressa on real estate and you can get in touch with me.
That's awesome. Chris, thank you so much for your time today. I do appreciate it.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen. If you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much and hope to catch you on the next episode.